on 2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty. Game on, weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Gordamila Mochaquib, lads, the two Johnnies, taking us through the afternoon there in entertaining fashion. It's Thursday, the 7th of April. I'm Shane Dawson, and you're listening to Game On. Coming up over the next hour, the Masters has teed off in Augusta. We'll be chatting to Greg Allen and Gary Moran as the opening day continues. Ruby Walsh, I should say, will be dialing in from Aintree on day one of the Grand National Festival. Plenty of drama there, but a largely disappointing day on the Irish front. Bernard Jackman will be live in studio as we preview a big weekend for the Irish provinces in the Champions Cup. And David Snaid will be getting us up to date on all things association football. As always, if you want to get in touch, you can drop us a text on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
GameOn2FM.
Yes, hello there. It is great to have your company on Game On. Thank you for joining us. Wherever in the world you are listening from, there is only one place to begin this evening, and that is turning our attention to golf and turning our attention to the Masters, because it is all teed off today and it's currently ongoing as I look at the scoreboard to see who's leading. Gooch, Higgs, Willett are all up there. Park Harrington was leading at one stage, but let's get the opinion of Greg Allen, who can give us a proper scene set because he is live in Augusta. Greg, what is happening today?
Well, there's only one person playing in the tournament according to the television cameras, and that's Tiger Woods, because he's doing awfully well as well. It's extraordinary to watch him. He's currently one under par after seven holes, and he's just one shot off the lead, and he's tied for second place. It's like nothing happened. It's like there was no car crash 14 months ago. There was no crushed leg. There was no scenario where he might have lost that leg. It's just like he's back and he's just normal. Now, he's not walking normally, but he's playing in the same vein as we've seen Tiger, obviously at his best for, you know, 2.5 decades or more. And one of the things that's notable about it is his demeanour. He is just all business. He had a poor tee shot off the first hole, and that was, you know, you could see the head go down straight away, disappointment, but he got a bit of a lucky break. He ended up with a shot to the green, came up short, chipped up to 8 feet. And you got a sense that if he hold that 8 footer, things were going to be good. If he didn't, you know, there was a par five to come in the second, he might get the shot back. But he hold the 8 footer dead center. And since then, there were four more pars, and then he made a really, really fine birdie on the sixth, where he speared a tee shot to within 1.5 feet, 2 feet of the hole. And then on the seventh, that trademark wonderful short game action that he has off a very tight lie. Golfers know how difficult it is to pitch off tight lies. He pitched from around 35 yards to 1.5 feet from the hole on the seventh. And that really is an indicator that all of those competitive juices that should really not be flowing so wonderfully are flowing extraordinarily in the same vein as they would have when Tiger Woods was playing tournaments, 20 tournaments a year. It's like he just hasn't gone away. But we do know that he always said about this week that walking is the big thing. The swing isn't the thing. He's putting well, chipping well, very obviously. Mind you, he probably did an awful lot of work in a short game when his leg was recovering and he couldn't play the long shots, the big shots with the driver and the irons. But there's no question that Tiger Woods believes he can win, and he's showing that he believes he can win as well, because on one under par after seven holes, he's one shot off the lead, and that leader is Taylor Gooch now, who's two under par after nine holes. Harry Higgs, Danny Willett, Daniel Berger, all one under par alongside Woods. Joaquin Niemann, the champion in Los Angeles on the PGA Tour a couple of months ago, he's one under par playing alongside Woods, as I said. Cameron Champ is one under par. Charles Schwartzel, former champion here, one under. Bob McIntyre, one under. And Justin Rose, one under. So very modest scoring. Now, Patrick Harrington was in a tie for the lead at one under par at one stage. He has dropped shots, though, on the 12th and also on the 16th. So two par threes where he's dropped shots. A three putt on the 16th just a short while ago. So he's one over par. Shane Lowry, one over after eight holes. And just underway is Seamus Power. And also Rory McIlroy will be bringing up the very back end of the field in terms of the players on the course. He'll be teeing off just after 7:30. And the key element of that is, because we had a half an hour weather delay, Rory, I think, is going to be chasing the sunset to see if he gets in, because the sunset is due at 7:50. And I reckon Rory will be finishing on the 18th around 7:50 to 8 o'clock. So whether or not there's enough hang light to get it in and finish his round and finish the first round remains to be seen. So Rory's yet to tee off. But no doubt about the story of the day so far. Tiger Woods on one under par after seven holes, playing the eighth hole now, which is a birdieable opportunity. He is just one behind the leader, Taylor Gooch. And in fact, Kanaya of Japan has just gone to 200 par, so two players leading now on 200, Kanaya and Gooch.
Okay, well, believe the hype. Tiger Woods is back. Gary Moran, as Greg mentioned there, Paul Carrington, just before we came on air, had a plus after his name for the first time. A sloppy long putt up the slope at 16 left a mile short, as Greg mentioned there. But I suppose a welcome surprise and a pleasing start for Paul Carrington, leading at one stage, as we mentioned. Shane Lowry won over at the moment, and Seamus Power just getting underway, and Rory McIlroy to come as well. So there's plenty to be excited about. And Gary, I know this is the first time we're having a chat about it, and has been mentioned with Gary Murphy and Doug Ferguson and indeed Greg himself, that this is so open this year, which is great to see. I know we're only on day one, but hopefully it's going to be this open come Sunday evening as well.
Yeah, well, Sunday evening at the Masters can be very exciting indeed, whether you're out there, whether you're watching on television or whatever. So let's hope it is like that, because the drama that can come on the back nine, we all know it. It can be absolutely fantastic, and huge swings can happen pretty quickly. I suppose the most impressive thing, or the thing that stands out for me really, is Tiger. Like, he's playing not perfectly. Nobody plays golf perfectly, but all elements of his game look fairly good, in fairly good order. I mean, I know he missed the fairway on the first and on the seventh, where he made a really good four, having driven into difficulty on the seventh, you know, punched up short of the bunker front right, superb pitch and hold the putt. It was excellent. And then the birdie before that on six, just a fabulous iron to, as Greg said, I think less than 2 feet. So he looks very good. I don't think Harrington will be that pleased, really, because he'd such a good start. And on the back nine, he hasn't really he didn't take advantage of either par five. In fact, he hit it into the water with his second on the 13th and played a super, nearly holed a pitch and then tapped in for par. Didn't birdie 15 either, and then bogeyed 16. So he'd be disappointed on his back nine performance for sure. Shane Lowry, I haven't seen too much of Shane Lowry's shots. But one over after nine and no birdies so far. But I mean, again, you know, you can go low on the back nine in particular if you're getting a run. So he's chances. Seamus Power short sided himself with his second to the first. So he's got a difficult up and down to try and salvage Power on the first, given the flag is on the right, he's on the right and doesn't have much green to work with.
Okay, Greg, what's the crowd reaction been like to Tiger? Because I know there's been so much said in the media, and you mentioned it's been all about Tiger. Will he, won't he? Well, he's teed off. Will he last is another question as well. But in terms of the excitement, I know from a journalistic point of view, a lot of the column face has been filled with Tiger Woods rhetoric. Has that been the same on the course with the fans? It's just all about Tiger?
Tiger is just a magnet for attention and I suppose fan interaction, because he's just so charismatic. The guy has lived the most dramatic life when you consider all the things that he's done in his life. Won by 12 shots around here back in, you know, 25 years ago, you know, setting a Masters record at 21 years of age. We know, of course, the indiscretion of 2009, the scandal, the winning the US Open on one leg in 2008 effectively because he had a busted ACL and a stress fracture. And obviously winning here in 2019 in a manner which was just extraordinary after career-saving back surgery. So everything is drama. So the American audience just loves a redemption story, a comeback story, and they're getting this comeback story here, which if it happened and just say Tiger Woods went on to win the Masters, it would make the comeback story of 2019 look almost a bit modest by comparison, because this was a leg injury which, you know, the surgeon said that amputation was, as the phrase that Tiger Woods has used himself, on the table as a possibility after the single car crash that he had when he, by the way, was speeding probably at twice the speed limit back in the February of last year. So, you know, to be in the position he's in now, you know, the patrons here, they're very well healed. I thought the atmosphere in the first tee, I was up in the first tee, I thought it was just a bit more muted than I expected. It wasn't US Open atmosphere, that's for sure. But there's a massive crowd following him. They love Tiger Woods. They want him to succeed. It's one of the great stories outside of just golf. It will be a massive sports story, and it will be up there alongside the greatest comebacks of all time, if not the greatest comeback of all time in sports, if he should pull off a victory here. But one of the things he's established already in the first couple of hours of his round, he's a contender. And it remains to be seen if he can withstand the obvious pain that he has to be in, because you can see he's limping. This is the ground very, very soft after a huge amount of overnight rain. So those hills will be harder to walk up, especially if he makes all four rounds. And I expect to see him limping more as the week goes on. And, you know, who knows? Just so long as he can withstand the pain. One thing is clear. The swing is there. The competitiveness is there. The steely eyes are already there. And in many ways, Tiger Woods is in a very good position to challenge her.
Yeah, I was reading a nice article there just before we came on air that read, the steel in his eyes, which has been evident since day dot, continues to burn. Nothing goes to chance nowadays. Every movement and every swing is carefully thought out. Every shot is meticulously placed. Tiger Mark 4 post-car crash looks awfully similar to Tiger Mark 3 post-back fusion. So certainly one. It's interesting though, Greg, you mentioned the kind of the duress that he'll be under just in terms of walking around. I know we touched on it yesterday, but it was actually only reading of a podcast interview that Tiger done himself, and it's CBD chewing gum, which is WADA approved, that apparently is getting him through the course and kind of getting him through the pain barrier as well. I'm not sure if either yourself or Gary heard much about that.
No, he does chew the CBD gum the whole time, but I think there might be more completely, you know, legal over-the-counter painkillers involved here. I don't think that Tiger Woods is relying on chewing gum to get through the pain that he has to be going through. I really think it's a lot worse than that. And there's obviously you can take completely legal painkillers as well, and I'm sure he has to take them because people don't think of golf as some sort of sedentary pastime. Golf is a 5-mile walk around here. And it's a 5-mile walk with acute elements of concentration involved and some fairly violent swings as well. And it's an activity which takes a lot out of you. I always remember playing golf with a very famous athlete who used to run marathons. And he said to me that sometimes after a round of golf, he felt more tired than he did after running marathons. So, you know, there are elements to golf which really do drain you. And it will remain to be seen. I think he's going to make the cut the way he's playing now. And that at the very least would be extraordinary. If he should challenge, it's another level of extraordinariness. But the fact that he's doing it and probably going to have to do it through pain, this is the guy who won, as I said, the US Open in a lot of pain in 2008, very obvious pain in 2008 when that ACL was busted and there was a stress fracture in his leg. You know, he's used to winning in pain. He's used to winning in mental sort of pain, I suppose, after the scandal that he suffered, not suffered, but that he went through. Obviously, it was his own indiscretion. I always remember in 2010, Billy Payne, the chairman of Augusta, basically admonished him in his address to the press at the 2010 Masters. And like Tiger must have been really, really, you know, feeling very low at that point because, you know, the focus of the world was on him coming back after the scandal. And there was Billy Payne of Augusta National chairman fame, you know, basically saying that he had let down children and let down people. And I remember on Sunday when Tiger rushed to the turn in 31 strokes to briefly have a chance of winning. It just shows you his ability to just put these things in the back of his head, whether it's mental pain or physical pain. And once he can swing the club, and he's swinging it awfully well, and hit those pitches and hold those putts, he may well be a factor on Sunday. No question about it in my mind now, having seen the way he started.
Okay, well, it will be interesting to see how it goes. Greg Allen, we're going to let you go and enjoy the rest of the day at Augusta. But before we do let you go, I know I credited Dustin Johnson was your pick. It's actually Cameron Smith. He's just birdied the 8th. So happy days. That is a positive note to end on there, Greg. But Gary Moran is still with us. And I suppose, Gary, we've talked at length about Tiger there. And we've talked about the Irish contingent as well, as I frantically check the leaderboard.
I have them here.
There you go. I'll just pose a question to you.
Yeah. Seamus Power played a superb chip on his first hole in Masters play and almost stone dead, tapped in for a par in the first. Shane Lowry is one over after 9, but has hit a tee shot into the left of left trees, I think, on 10, so not where you want to be on that hole. And Padraig Harrington also bogeyed 17, so from one under on the front 9, he's now 2 over. He hit his second over the back of the green, left himself difficult up and down, didn't get that close with the chip and missed that. So not great for him. So Takumi Kanaya, the outright leader now on 2 under. Several players on 1 under, including, as we've said, Tiger Woods. I'll name a couple of others. Whacking Neiman, Charles Schwartzel, Danny Willett, so who is a former Masters champion, of course. And the likes of Bryson DeChambeau, level after 8. Scotty Scheffler, new world number 1, level after 6. But look, it's really early days. I can understand why there's so much focus on Tiger.
Yeah.
He's living up to it right now.
Absolutely. But listen, we know how a few of the runners and riders are going at the moment. But I suppose to put you on the spot, who do you fancy, Gary?
I don't fancy Tiger to win it. It would be incredible.
I think it would be a step too far.
I think so.
Yeah.
Who would I have picked?
See, I credited Dustin Johnson to Greg about two or three times yesterday, and then he did speak at length, and Doug Ferguson went with Xander Schauffele, I think, actually, end. And then Greg came back to Cameron Smith as well. So I've gone Cameron Smith each way just because Greg Allen told me to, so I can blame him. So if I was say, even in each way shout, I can blame you, Gary.
Well, I'll go with the man in form, Scotty Scheffler.
Okay. The world number one.
He is the world number one, but no one really, I'm not saying no one expects him to win this, but I mean, you don't expect him to win it. And he's not most people's first choice, but he's been playing so well. He's had a couple of Masters under his belt already, so let's see how he goes.
Okay, well, it will be interesting to see how it goes. Three of the Irish are out at the moment, and as mentioned, Rory McIlroy due to go out at around 7:30 because of the delayed start. Gary Moran, thank you very much. A pleasure as always chatting all things golf and the Masters. We will be turning our attention to horse racing in a few moments' time, but first, it is competition time, and Dublin artist Aches has teamed up with EA Sports to create an exclusive Dublin City kit for FIFA 22. Known for his murals and graffiti art, Aches moves from the street to football by designing a unique kit bringing Dublin to life in game. This limited edition vanity kit is now available in FIFA Ultimate Team, and to celebrate its release, we are giving away a copy of FIFA 22 each day this week. And not only that, but tomorrow one of our five daily winners will get their own signed limited edition Aches jersey. So to be in with a chance to win today and to get in the draw, all you have to do is answer the following question: which France international scored a hat-trick at Stamford Bridge last night? Text your answer, your name and where you're from to 51552. As always, RTE competition terms and conditions apply. See 2fm.ie for details. So the question again: which France international scored a hat-trick at Stamford Bridge last night? As promised, we'll have horse racing next.
RTE 2FM.
On
2FM with Green Farm. Being up to 90 isn't real. The protein in our range is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on.
Racing.
Hey, you're very welcome back to Game On this Thursday evening as we turn our attention to horse racing and specifically the Aintree Grand National Festival. And our own Ruby Walsh is over in Aintree for the week. It is day one of the festival, Ruby, and a disappointing day for Ireland, I suppose, overall. If we go through the grade ones in chronological order, the first race of the day was the novices chase at 1:45. Rachel Blackmore came fourth with Miller's Bank winning. But I suppose a good Irish story there is Keelan Woods was the winning jockey.
Yeah, great success for Keelan Woods. I mean, started his trade in Ireland, didn't have much success, moved to the UK and worked his way up through the ranks. He's a hard-working young man who's taken every opportunity he's gotten. He's had two winners at the Cheltenham Festival. He had a winner there this year when he won the Grand Annual. And he's come on to Aintree and for Alex Hales and won the Manifesto Novices Chase and Miller's Bank. Gave him a really good ride. Gin and Lime went along in front for Rachel Blackmore. But Keelan Woods produced Miller's Bank going to the last fence, jumped it really well, and he was an impressive winner in the end.
A bit of drama then in the 220. So Knight Salute was the eventual winner after a dead heat with Pied Piper, but Knight Salute getting the victory after a steward's inquiry. The right decision in the end, Ruby?
Ah, very difficult one. I suppose if you're being really technical about it, Shane, yes, it probably was, because technically Pied Piper did come off a straight line and Knight Salute had to alter his course to get past. But you know, you could argue that what Davy Russell did was he slowed Pied Piper on the approach to the last hurdle and altered his line to the jump to give himself more room to jump the jump. His horse was meeting on an uneven stride, so he went a little bit left to get the stride he wanted, and Knight Salute was coming from behind him and could have changed his course if he wanted to. It was a dead heat, so look, the steward said that interference did take place, and because it was a dead heat, therefore the natural assumption is that Pied Piper gained an advantage. It could have went either way. I suppose the stewards looked at it in very black and white terms. Maybe that's the way all refereeing, sporting, stewarding decisions should be. But I could have thought this. I thought this was one that could have went either way. I didn't think it was as black and white as a lot of people. And Pied Piper was demoted. Look, he'd probably been in front sooner than Davy Russell wanted to anyway. He said that himself in his interview afterwards. He moved to cover Brazil going to the third last hurdle, but Brazil folded quickly and that left Pied Piper in front. And Yeah, it was just unlucky, but it was a good ride from Paddy Brennan and a first grade one success for Milton Harris's Night Salutes trainer, Milton, who worked on the cruise ships himself in his younger years for 10 years. Is a trainer having a great season, and it was a big day for him.
Yeah, certainly. Well done to Paddy and Milton there. And unlucky for Davy Russell and Gordon Elliott just missing out in that one. Moving on to the bowl then, we will be chatting all things Man United and Manchester United managers with David Snaid a little bit later. But the winning horse, part-owned by Alex Ferguson.
Yeah, Sir Alex owns a share in Clandestobo, who won the race last year. He also owned What a Friend, who won the race many years ago. I was lucky enough to ride him. He loves having winners at Aintree. He was there himself today and he was in great form. Even if the wind was howling and the rain was lashing down on top of him, it didn't seem to bother Sir Alex. He was in really good form, and Paul Nicholls has done a really good job to get this horse back to the top level. I mean, when I watched him in Newbury on his last start, I thought there was no way he'd ever again win a Grade 1. He's gone and won an Aintree today, and he'll probably come to Punchestown and try and do what he did last year and win the Punchestown Gold Cup as well. He held Conflated by a length, but I think Clandestobo had plenty left in the locker, and I'd say the application of blinkers was a good addition to Clandestobo by Paul Nicholls.
And it shows you what I know about horse racing, Ruby. After me giving Kenboy the big sale yesterday, you know, and he only came third.
Yeah, still he came third. It was a decent enough run out of him. There was a big enough field, Shane. There was more than 8 runners, wasn't there? Yeah, there was 9 runners. So yeah, you got paid each way if you back Kenboy. He was 5-1. You got your money back, Shane. Look at the positives.
Yeah, it's small margins. Moving on to the final Grade 1 then. A good day for Henderson and Aidan Coleman.
Yeah, Epitant. Look, she was going to win either way. She'd arrive besides Anna here going to the last hurdle, travelling absolutely, pulling double over Zanahir. Zanahir was a bit brave and took a heavy fall, but it was good to see both him and Jack Kennedy get up. And Epitant ran out a 14-length winner. Zanahir would have been second. It would have been a third consecutive second for Gordon Elliott in the Grade 1. So it was a near sort of a day for the Cullintra House team. But they have big chances again tomorrow, and a huge team in the Grand National, so their turn could come at this meeting yet. But Epitant was a really good winner, and she'll likely come to Punchestown now to take on Honeysuckle in the Paddy Power Champion Hurdle on the Friday of that meeting.
Yeah, certainly cannot wait for that one. Before we do move on to tomorrow, Ruby, anything other outstanding caught your eye today? Wet and windy day.
I was happy enough to be in the ITV truck out of the conditions. It suited me this afternoon, Shane. But late night pass was very good in the Fox Hunters. The handicap chase went the way of the last day, who beat Dancing on My Own for Henry de Bromhead. And then the Irish did eventually get on the scoreboard. Astro Diamond, Willie Mullins and Patrick Mullins won the Goffs UK Nickel Coin Mare Standard Open National Hunt Flat Race by 6 lengths. She ran out a ready winner for the Blue Blood Racing Club, and there was a lot of Blue Blood Racing Club members in Aintree to enjoy her success this afternoon, and I'm sure they'll have a really good night in Liverpool tonight.
Absolutely, good stuff. Well, moving on to tomorrow, Ruby, and I suppose, you know, you challenged me to come big today with at least one tip, and what I'm going for, Ruby, is 220, the novices hurdle. So in my humble opinion here, and this is doing my diligent journalistic research that we were chatting about yesterday, I'm going with El Fabiolo for Willie Mullins, because listen, as we all know, he was bought after running twice in France. He bolted up on stable debut with Tremor New Year's Day, landing a maiden hurdle by 13 lengths. So that's who I'm going for in the first Grade 1. I don't know about yourself, Ruby.
That was impressive, Shane. Very impressive. Beat a horse called Tempo Chapter 2, who has since gone and won a couple of races. So, yeah, I wouldn't put anybody off Il Fabiolo. And actually, yesterday afternoon, when I was flying into Liverpool at the luggage belt, Paul Townend was standing a couple of people down from me, and different people were asking him for a tip or a winner or what was his best chance, and he put up El Fabiolo as his best ride at the meeting. So maybe that leaked all the way back to Dublin, Shane, and you heard that, and that's where you're going for El Fabiolo. But look, he is a decent horse. He's owned by Simon Muneer and Isaac Suede. He's travelled over well. Willie's had a winner today. He does have to take on John Bond. Nicky Henderson and Aidan Coleman won the Aintree hurdle today, and John Bond was a good second at the Cheltenham Festival in the Supreme, the Constitution Hill. So John Bond will be no pushover, but Il Fabiolo, I wouldn't put anybody off either.
Happy days. Well, I got third today with Kenboy. Hopefully Il Fabiolo might be second, and then who knows, might get the winner in the Grand National itself on Saturday. But moving on to the Novices Chase 5-3 tomorrow, probably one of the races of the afternoon on day two of the meeting, it's fair to say.
Absolutely. Only 4 runners, but you've Lam Presse, who won the Brown Advisory at the Cheltenham Festival, beat a High Senior, he runs again, and you have Brave Man's Game, Paul Nicholls' star, who didn't run at Cheltenham because of the rain, Hopefully he'll line up tomorrow. Look, Braveman's game won the big novice chase in Kempton at Christmas, the Colo Star novice chase. He then went to Newbury and won really well, but I was really taken with Long Presse at the Cheltenham Festival. I loved him the last sort of 100 yards of the race, Shane. I loved how he seemed to just change gear and pull away, and I was looking at him thinking, there's a Gold Cup horse in the making. So I'm in the Long Presse camp. Plenty of people will be with Braveman's game, but I'm with Venetia Williams and Charlie Deutsch here.
Okay, and in the following race, if we're sticking with the previewing of the Grade Ones, Half Tree de Marche Chase?
Yeah, look, I think this looks, it could look Fakir Dudari's nearly to lose. Look, he skipped the Cheltenham Festival because he's run against Alaho on three occasions in the past, and Alaho has just been too good for him every time. So Connections decided to swerve Cheltenham and come here with Fakir Dudari. He beat two for goal in Ascot on his last start. The big opposition probably comes from Funambul Sivala of Venetia Williams, as he was second to Enner Gourmet at the Cheltenham Festival in the Champion Chase. But I'm not certain about Funambul Sivala's stamina, so I'm with Fakir Dudari as well. And if it was a day of near misses in the big ones for Ireland today, I think Fakir Dudari will be the one tomorrow.
Well, hopefully it is a bit more of a positive day for Ireland tomorrow. The final Grade 1 of Friday comes in the Sefton Novices Hurdle over the extended 3 miles, Ruby.
Yeah, I think this is a weak enough Grade 1. I think you could, look, there, it's just, I suppose, there can be poor FA Cups, poor World Cups. Every competition, every sport can have a weak division. I think this is a weak race for the calibre of contest it's supposed to be. But I'm going to stick with Keelan Woods. And I think Bow to Greatness, trained by Ben Pauling even. He's a massive price. I think he could be a good bet each way here on what looks a substandard Grade 1.
Okay, well, a good day for Keelan Woods today. Hopefully it is tomorrow as well, as you say. Anything else catch your eye? I suppose there's a couple of Grade 3s, the 5 past 4,
yeah,
one of the trickiest events.
A couple of really competitive handicaps that didn't really, nothing really jumped out at me, Shane. I think I will retire for the evening and start studying the Grand National to see if I can find a winner of that.
Well, that is the big one, and Ruby will be chatting plenty of that tomorrow, and we'll be reviewing all of tomorrow's races. Ruby Walsh, enjoy your evening in Liverpool. As I say, I mentioned my jealousy yesterday and it hasn't subsided today anyway, but great chatting to you, and we'll be checking in with you again tomorrow.
Cheers, Shane. Thanks a million.
RTE
2FM.
On
2FM with Green Farm. Being flat to the mat isn't real. Our protein is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on.
Rugby.
Now, you're very welcome back to Game On in this Thursday evening as we turn our attention to rugby in the company of Bernard Jackman. And Bernard will be chatting all things Heineken Champions Cup and previewing the weekend's action. Of course, all of the Irish provinces are in action. But first, sad news this week. Former Scotland and British and Irish Lions prop Tom Smith sadly passed away aged 50. Smith, who was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer in November 2019, also played for Glasgow Warriors, Caledonia Reds and Northampton. Smith made 61 appearances for Scotland and 6 for the Lions over 2 tours in 97 and 2001. Bernard, a great character of the game.
Yeah, a legend. I think a lot of us remember him from the 97 Lions tour, you know, that the documentary Living with Lions, where himself and Paul Wallace and Keith Wood were the front row that took on a gigantic South African pack and did well. And I got to know him a little bit in France. He was coaching in Brive. Very quiet guy, but the lads who played with him, I played against him when he played for Northampton, but anyone who played with him just said he's the kind of fella you'd go to war with, and he'd go to war for you. Very reliable character, very unassuming, very powerful, even though he was small in stature, very powerful. And it's very sad. Like, you know, I think we all knew he was sick, but to be honest with you, I'd forgotten about it, or he was out of my mind a little bit because I had, you know, with COVID and being out of the professional game. But yeah, to hear his passing and at such a young age and with a young family, it's very sad.
Yeah, absolutely. Our sincere condolences go out to all of Tom Smith's friends, families and former teammates and everyone in the rugby world associated with Tom. Very sad news this week. So, Bernard, moving on to the action and over to go chronologically, I suppose, tomorrow evening, Connacht v Leinster at 8 p.m. out west in the sports ground. Bundy Aki has been named in the Connacht team to face Leinster in tomorrow's clash. The Ireland centre makes a first appearance since the Six Nations clash against Scotland on the 19th 19th of March. There's also a first start of the season for Gavin Thornbury after coming off the bench in last weekend's URC win over Benetton in Italy. Jared Butler also returns for the round of 16 first leg match after missing the Treviso victory through injury. As expected, Ireland and Leinster skipper Johnny Sexton returns to the visitor squad's squad after being rested for the last 2 months. Hugo Keenan remains a fullback with Jimmy O'Brien scorer of 4 tries in Leinster's last European outing, and James Lowe on the wing. Leo Cullen has made wholesale changes to the front five with Keane Healy, Dan Sheehan, Tadhg Furlong, Ross Maloney and Josh Murphy coming in. Is it crass of me to say Connacht will give Leinster more of a game than Munster did?
Look, Munster weren't really at the races. I think that was a very comfortable victory for Leinster, and I think Connacht will look to rise it tomorrow night. They're underdogs, obviously. Leinster are sending down a very strong side. But this is Connacht's first time in the knockout stages of Europe. When you look back at how they qualified, I think they're the only qualifier who had to play the 4 games. Mm. Everyone else had a weekend off, and now the reward for battling through those 4 games, ironically only winning one of them but being very good at picking up bonus points, is they get to play Leinster home and away, which, when you think about their squad, smaller than all the others, they've had injuries. It's really testing that squad, and it may cost them qualification for Europe for next year, because I think it has affected their URC form, and there's certainly been a dip in that. But they have to treat tomorrow like a knockout game, even though we know there's another leg next week.
Yeah.
And you can see by Leo Cullen's selection, I think he's looking to get it done. With a week in advance, going back to the Viva, being able to make some changes next week. But I think the atmosphere, I'm lucky enough to go down there tomorrow, I think the atmosphere in the sports ground will be phenomenal. Bundy Aki, even though he's only one player, and Leinster bringing back lots of internationals, Sexton amongst them, I think the galvanising effect that Bundy can have, he's a real talisman for them. I think he can lift everybody else. And you mentioned Thornbury. Thornbury's being back is a really good boost for Connacht. Plus, interestingly, they've picked Fifita, the second row from they signed from Grenoble, the Tonga international, to bring in a bit of bulk there. And Leinster, you know, Leinster second row partnership, 2 really good players, Josh Murphy and Ross Maloney. But I think they were planning to play Joe McCarthy, but he picked up a knock this week. So it's Connacht play great rugby. It's kind of a bit like, Kevin Keegan, we'll outscore you stuff, but it's risky against Leinster because their attack is so good as well. It's quite hard to outscore Leinster. I think of scoring over 30 points on average per game, so it's going to be a huge contest, you know. And it's hard to see Connacht getting a win, but I think they will outperform the expectation tomorrow night.
Well, hopefully it's a competitive fixture, and obviously with the 2 legs you won't have any real kind of underdog story. I suppose looking back at North Macedonia against Italy and so on over the 2 legs, it probably will be a Leinster win, but it should be really interesting tomorrow evening. It should be a great atmosphere down in Galway, and there's commentary on RT Radio of that one. Going chronological order onto Saturday, 3:15, Toulouse v Ulster. All signs point towards this round of 16 first leg being an evenly matched encounter. The teams have faced off 12 times in the competition, including an entertaining opening round clash last season, and have won 5 games each, drawing once. Am I reading too much into history here, Bernard?
I think Ulster obviously have a chance, but I know that Toulouse are really targeting Europe this year. They feel really hard done by. They wanted to play their last round game against Cardiff at home. The EPCR felt that there was too much COVID and awarded Cardiff the victory, and that cost Toulouse a seeding place. So effectively, you know, Ulster's reward for finishing very high up is to play Toulouse, who are probably the most dangerous team in it, and they're actually struggling a little bit in the top 14. Obviously they produce so many players for France, and the top 14 runs during the Six Nations, they've lost some games that they normally would win. And yeah, they're the holders, and they know going to Ravenhill will be incredibly tough. So I think if Ulster can get through this weekend just with a narrow loss, even, they would fancy their chances the following week. And but just watching Dupont every week, he just has a moment of absolute brilliance, and Just watching him, it'll be worth the game in itself.
Yeah, no, he's a scary talent, and it's great to see what he can do. And hopefully, from an Irish perspective, Ulster can come away from France with a good result and bring him back to Belfast and see what happens. 5:30 on Saturday evening, Exeter Chiefs versus Munster. Before we talk about what might happen on the pitch, will Munster have a new head coach by then?
I doubt it. They'll have it tomorrow, unless the Irish View and Munster surprises. Look, I think the loss to Leinster last week, I think this, the effect is starting to have on crowds. I think they'll want to get a good news story out there. I think it's a disgrace that they've let it last this long. I mean, Johan van Graan told them in November, we know it's a World Cup year, there's not a lot of coaches on the market, but they haven't been very active. I know agents who've been trying to get in front of them since December, and they just said they're not ready to look at it yet. And you snooze, you lose. You know, those coaches have now moved on, and it looks like Graham Rowntree is the favourite, and maybe he was the best candidate all along, but I think if anyone looked at it forensically, the process that they've carried out hasn't been what you'd expect from a club like Munster. They haven't been anywhere near reactive enough, and it's sad really, because you know, they've had 5 years with Johan van Graan. They don't look to move forward. There was an opportunity to go out and do something to help take control of your own destiny, and it looks like they've been pretty sloppy in that. So look, that's where it's at the moment. They may announce it next week, and I think from Munster's point of view and for the players' point of view, they need to get the head coach appointed quickly so he can get his staff ready. And let's be honest, I mean, some of the people that he'll probably be looking at are under contract elsewhere, so the longer it goes on, the less likely he will be to be able to get the right people that he wants, and it's a knock-on effect. So yeah, pretty amateur process from in my point of view.
Yeah, well, they will be up against it. They'll be licking their wounds from that Leinster loss, and Exeter very strong at home as well, so we'll be interested to see how that goes. That kicks off at 5:30 on Saturday evening, and that ends our rugby union chat. Bernard Jackman, a pleasure as always. We'll be chatting soccer in a few moments' time.
RTE 2FM.
Game on
2FM with Green Farm. Rise and grind, and the hustle mindset aren't real. The protein in our chicken and turkey is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on.
Football.
Now, you're very welcome back to the last part of Game on this Thursday evening, as we turn our attention to football, association football, soccer, whatever you want to call it. I'm in the company of David Snaid. David, I suppose let's start with European football and last night's results. Chelsea 1, Real Madrid 3, Villarreal 1, Bayern Munich 0. So starting with Stamford Bridge, it's all about one man. And I see, I'm hesitant to give away his name, because I did ask a question at the start of the show, which France international scored a hat-trick at Stamford Bridge last night, but I suppose there's no getting away from it. David...
K Benzema, maybe, or
he was the cream of the crop.
Well, first of all, I'm actually shocked that he's asked me to be back into the studio today, considering yesterday when we were previewing the games, my first thing what I said was that Chelsea would just about nick it.
Yeah.
And then he asked me in a word, you asked me about the Bayern Munich and Villarreal. I gave you two. Robert Lewandowski didn't score.
You got too smart.
I know, I got ahead of myself.
This is why our off-air chats are just League of Ireland, United Church League based. We don't go into this money.
And listen, we don't know anything about that either.
Yeah.
But no, it was just, and also I meant to say, and you said this to me yesterday, but you were the one asking the questions. But remember, I asked you about Carlo Ancelotti.
I was trying
who
to finish
five
up
clubs.
Wrapping up the show. What was the question again?
So if he wins the league with Real Madrid this year, which more than likely they will, leave them to 12 points clear in the league, they could make it a double now, because they're obviously flying in the Champions League after that win last night. He could become the first manager in history to win a league title in top five leagues in Europe.
Yeah.
So obviously AC Milan, Italy, yeah. Chelsea, Premier yeah. League, PSG in France, because obviously in the last little while every manager there has won a trophy. Say for me, Pochettino, someone who has never won a trophy, can actually win a trophy at PSG. That's how easy it is in Ligue 1.
No.
I have to get the kickstart one license through the FAI to even get near that job. But you watched that game last night, Karim Benzema, and what was Ancelotti said, he's aging like a fine wine.
Yeah.
And the performances, like the build up to the goals, and like that second header, like the first header is just amazing. Like the
ridiculous.
But even like you've watched the build up to it, like the outside of the boot pass, but also, and it's like we mentioned the kickstart one, but this is something that kids from the age of 6 are taught, is don't stand and admire your pass, follow it, see where the danger is. And that's exactly what he done. He's 34 years of age, but he's doing the basics still. And everything was basic until that finish. And that header, that first header with the power on it and just the anticipation of knowing where Vinicius was going to put the ball, was just fantastic. And then that second goal, I think I watched it back about 6 or 7 times today, looking at it. And you're
he just
thinking,
lets it hit him.
That's the thing. He almost, I think it's brilliant. I don't know, like, it'd be great to actually, like, be one of those articles that in a little while where it's just talk you through what's going through your head and the mechanics behind that goal, because obviously Modric puts the ball in fantastic and he's kind of looking at it and he's probably thinking, right, the trajectory on the ball, the pace on the ball, a bit of the spin, he realises he doesn't need to get a bit of his, obviously, the neck behind it and put pace on it. It's just about, as you were saying, let it hit him on the
in
the mush
more.
Essentially,
yeah.
And then just direct it. And I think that's even what catches out Mendy's probably thinking he might go, because if you're looking at it as well, he may be thinking, right, I'll go to keeper's right and just put it where it, but he goes, he puts it back where it's coming from, and to do that, and it was just incredible. And in fairness, like, I think Mendy obviously seemed to have a bit of an appreciation for him, because he put on the play for him for the hat trick. Did he score the hat trick? I don't know, because I don't know if that quiz. Yeah, so
our winner will be revealed, and I can say it won't be David Snaid. Sorry, just to defend Mendy, because you know I'm obviously going to go all in on Goalkeepers Union here. That was Rudiger's fault for not going. I know he was booked, but that's Rudiger's fault for not going full throttle. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's also, I think it's also a little bit of an element of just a bit of game management. So early in the second half, how many seconds was it into the second half? 20, 30 seconds into the second half.
Yeah.
He's well out of his goal, playing a square pass that far out.
Yeah, no, he was rattled. Like, he was rattled.
Yeah, and I don't think any Chelsea fan in that moment would have been like complaining if he just put it down the channel and got it clear, like, you know. But then this comes back to that whole kind of maybe the impact, obviously, that Pep Guardiola has had on the game, in the sense that goalkeepers aren't expected now to be the ones who play. And if Mendy had just put it out into touch or cleared his lines, Tuchel would have been like, that's not what you want, we need you to do, you need to have the confidence, you need to have the bravery to be the one to actually keep possession. So you do have to take the rough with the smooth, but considering what Tuchel's comments were afterwards, which, like, he fairly ripped into the team in terms of talking about the toys not no longer.
Do you agree with him? Because I'm assuming the journalist that asked that expected, well, sure, it's only half time, there's lots to play, we'll head over to there with optimism. But he's like, no, sorry, we've been awful since the international break. Yeah. This was awful last week against Brentford. It's more the same, not good enough at this level. If we see the same this weekend at Southampton, it's good night.
Yeah, like, I don't think it is. Yeah, like, me. Yeah, me.
Well, I disagree with Tuchel.
Yeah, no. like, it's. I would imagine. I would say what would have played into it, his reaction would have been like he probably would have been speaking to the press. Obviously, it was the written press and the press conference. So maybe you're probably talking the guts about 40 minutes, maybe 45 minutes after the game. He's still coming off just being so angry, I would imagine, and disappointed, and maybe the adrenaline is still gone, and he wants to get a certain message out. But like, can you see Chelsea going there and doing Madrid properly? Not really. You could maybe see them scoring a couple of goals because he still have so much attacking threat. Like, you see Ziyech coming off the bench as well and at half time, and like Lukaku too. Like, so like Chelsea are well capable of going there, obviously, and getting a result. Of course they are. But when you see maybe where, obviously, what's happening with Benzema, you see how Modric was playing last night, and just sometimes you get a feel of a toy of how it's gone and what's happening with Chelsea at the moment. Obviously, since just now about the international break and even before that, they were. It's beginning, everything that's happened with Abramovich. I think
it's just unravelling.
It is unravelling. And listen, you'd like to say it's sad to see, but it's not. Let's be honest. You see what Chelsea, that club, stands for over the last number of years. And, you know, it's okay to actually revel in it a small bit.
I'm staying impartial because I'm probably going to be sharing a studio with Paul Carey in a couple of weeks as well. So I know he's a big Chelsea fan. Listen, moving on, Villarreal 1, Bayern Munich 0. No Robert Lewandowski to be seen. Was Arnaud Danjuma with the 8-minute goal. And Coughlin had a goal ruled out by VAR as well. Just briefly on this, David, I suppose. Yeah, listen, great result for Villarreal, but they're going to have to do the exact same and a bit more when they go back to Munich, I suspect.
Like, in this one, you would be expecting Bayern to be able to put a bit of a show on and put serious pressure on. But like, you listen to the comments, say, from Dan Juma after the game and what he's talking about Unai Emery, and like, you kind of look at how things went for him at Arsenal and how he was kind of ridiculed a little bit. But like, this is a top class manager who knows how to set a team up, and he did it perfectly. You kind of look back, and I suppose if I had been able to give a bit more insight last night rather than one word, I would have said, listen, how good they were against Juventus, and they were able to knock Juventus out. So like, they're no mugs. Like, they have won the Europa League, they did a number on Man United, even bringing it to penalties, but were by far the better team in that game and deserved it. And yeah, like, sometimes even with a manager, and when a team or a group of players buy into how a manager sets up and how he interacts with the players and how he gets out and the stuff he gets out of them, and sometimes it just elevates a squad of players. And when you go into a match with something to protect, it sometimes, like, you would expect Bayern Munich have been in this position before, or maybe they haven't, I suppose, because they've been so dominant even in Europe, but they're chasing the game a little bit. But there's just, you get the sense there should be far too much experience in that Bayern team to panic. Like, if they're, like, they're well capable of coming out and blitzing Villarreal early doors. They do it all regularly, obviously, in the Bundesliga. They do what they did in the previous round when winning 8-2. Like, they're well capable, if they hit form, of, regardless of how the team is set up, of doing a number on them. But I don't know, after that 1-0, like, they'll be going out with their tails up Villarreal. So I don't think people should be writing them off either. I certainly won't.
You mentioned there that you would have been given out a more elegant answer. Don't be blaming time constraints for getting a prediction wrong. That's all I'll say. Okay?
Listen, I don't think me and elegance go in the same sentence. To be honest.
Listen, moving on. Obviously, Burnley defeated Everton 3-2. So the relegation battle is up and running. And Frank Lampard blaming individual mistakes. Sean Dyche's comments at half time. He said, I'm not sure these know how to win a game, lads, away from home particularly. Yeah. So them fighting words, as they say. But moving on from that and turning to Manchester, because I know we did speak yesterday, or I promoed it, that Erik ten Hag was reported that it's a done deal by ESPN. We're reporting it that it's a done deal, and Miguel Delaney, I think, was mentioning that it's a 5-year project, which was what was brought up in the interview. He had a dossier with specific emphasis on conditioning and lack of Champions League shape. I mean, if he wants to play the game he wants to play in this high pressing, high tempo, and everything else that comes with it, I mean, the players have given up on Rangnick already in that regard, so it's going to be a lot longer than a 5-year turnaround.
I know. Well, it could be, or it might not, depending on just, I suppose, how ruthless he's able to be and how ruthless the club can be, because there's a lot of players in that United dressing room, some of them obviously whose contracts are going to be running up, like obviously Paul Pogba will be gone, Jesse Lingard will be gone, Juan Mata, who's probably the nicest man in the world, he'd also be leaving, you would imagine. But it could be a 5-year project, and that's probably what needs to happen. But the problem will be what's always happened with United, especially since obviously Ferguson's left over the last it's going to be 10 years, it's basically been a lost decade, because there's going to have to be a lot of pain before there will be any kind of progress, you would suspect, just because there's been so many different managers in there, different philosophies, I suppose, is the buzzword. It's clear there's a dressing room in there that is mentally not capable of lads who are not able to play for Manchester United and the demands that come with it. And it all just depends on if he is able, and the new structure there that is, and because it is one of those aspects now as well, when you tie in, and we've spoken about this before, about the structure that Ten Hag works under. But like John Murtagh, who's the new football director, he's going to have a new fella coming under him as well as an assistant, and you have Darren Fletcher, who's obviously the technical director. He's now going to be able to focus on that role properly, because obviously he's had to be in, basically almost like seconded to be in with Ralph Rangnick, almost as an assistant, you know. So like, I said this before, I don't think things are ever as bad as they seem, and are never quite as good as they seem in football, because it can change very quickly. All you have to do is ask some of the Bowles fans who are being Keith Long not so long ago after they got their underway on their night. But if you look at what can happen, if that structure that is in place now at Man United, obviously Ed Woodward is gone, if that begins to work, well, that maybe you would see some of the fruits of that labour. But the big issue, and it's the elephant in the room, is based over in Florida, is when you've got a family who are running the club who, don't care about the football side of things, once they're able to take out their dividends, and that's essentially what they've done, even though they have put money into the club, but it hasn't been their money, it's been money that the club has generated themselves and could possibly have been even utilised even better. But it just strikes me that it's a new manager, possibly coming in, but there are still some more problems there that need to be rectified.
Well, it certainly is a conversation that I suspect we'll be having in the weeks to come. David, thank you very much for your company. We will be chatting League of Ireland tomorrow evening, but just to finish our soccer chat, Piemont United striker Stephanie Roach has raced into an early lead in the Golden Boot Stakes and has taken the Women's National League Player of the Month award for March this morning. So many congratulations to Stephanie. Greg Allen, as the Big Tom song goes, we'll go out the same way we came in. How is life in Augusta since we last chatted about 40 minutes ago?
You know, life is pretty good for Tiger Woods. He's just par the 10th. He had a bit of trouble down the left-hand side and had to negotiate trees for a second. Missed the green short and left, but that lovely, beautiful short game of his came to his rescue, and he's just saved par from the left front of that green. A very difficult chip up the slope, but he's holed out there for a par. So Tiger Woods, level par after 10 holes, and he's just two shots off the lead. It is quite a story. And leading is Cameron Smith.
There you go.
Par after 10 holes. Did I tip Cameron?
I think you did. Yeah, I think I'm not sure if you caught me earlier. It's like I had a meet way as well, and I'm blaming you, Greg, if he doesn't come in. So listen, great chatting as always, Greg.